team.
Prison Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
My name's Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today on our show, we'll be airing an interview with John Moore. John Moore is an Ojibwe man from Serpent River First Nation who was convicted of second-degree murder in 1978. He will be talking about his wrongful conviction with one of the hosts of the Prison Radio Show. We will also be interviewing live someone who will be giving a report back from the demonstration that happened last weekend in solidarity with the women who have been moved from Tongay Prison into LeClaire Prison. But first, we have a lot of news items for you. The Prison Radio Show received a letter a few months ago from Chaz Ransom, the president of the Lifers and Long-Termers Organization at Otisville Medium State Prison in North Country, New York State. We regret that this news has taken so long to get to the airwaves, but Chaz wanted folks to know that, and this is a long quote, a recent court decision in the Anthony Sistrunk case has forced the Board of Parole to grant a significant number of de novo hearings to those who raised the issues of the board's failure to weigh the COMPAS risk and needs assessment and the TAP/case plan in deliberations for release consideration. In accordance with the requirements of 9 NYCRR 8002.3A12, the TAP/case plan is a new required factor to be weighed by the board and were not being offered at most facilities, nor presented for review by the board as required. To ascertain whether the board reviewed your case plan, check the hearing decision notice. To ascertain when your facility began to provide case plans to the board for review, you must write a FOIL request to the Senior Offender Rehabilitation Coordinator to request whether the facility prepared and supplied the case plan to the board for your parole appearance. If the case plan was not present, then you must submit that issue in your administrative appeal. If you have already submitted your appeal, then you must write to the appeals unit to amend your appeal. If your appeal was denied, you must write to the appeals unit for reconsideration. You can address letters to Kathleen M. Kiley, which is K-I-L-E-Y, Counsel to the Board of Parole, 1220 Washington Avenue, Building Number 2, Albany, New York, 12226. Again, that was a notice for prisoners in New York State. The information was coming from Chaz Ransom, the president of the Lifers and Long-Termers Organization at the Otisville Medium State Prison in New York State. Thank you so much, Chaz, for bringing this to our attention. And for listeners who want a written copy of this information, you can write to us at the Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS, care of CKUT 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3, and we can send you a copy of these instructions.
Wapa Shitoe Mondo A.N. Wilanga, a political prisoner of 45 years, died in his prison cell on Friday, March 11th at the Nebraska State Penitentiary. He was 68 years old. Mondo was a Black Panther in Omaha who was sentenced to life in prison at the age of 23. He died of complications from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mondo maintained his innocence until the very end and refused to apply for compassionate release, wanting nothing less than full exoneration by the state of Nebraska. You can read more about his life at sfbayview.com. Prisoners in Texas are going on a strike starting April 4th. According to chrisblebedeb.com, their top five demands are meaningful work time, which means good work time equals 100% and folks should be entitled to mandatory parole at the earliest possible release date, repeal/overturn the $100 medical copay, the right to an attorney on habeas corpus, a restructured grievance process and the creation of an independent committee to review and investigate prisoners' grievances, and finally, humane living conditions and treatment, including air conditioning during the summer, adequate medical care, sufficient and nutritious meals, limited use of solitary confinement, education for administrative segregation prisoners, a four-stage process to release confirmed segregation prisoners from solitary confinement, freedom of religion and association, and a fix for leaking roofs and roach infestations. As of Monday, April 4th, 2016, Texas prisoners will begin a series of statewide work stoppages, strikes, and slowdowns to force the Texas legislature to address much-needed reform to the parole, medical, grievance, and legal system in Texas. The prisoners are using Facebook to spread the word about retaliation they may end up facing from guards, as well as to share messages of actions at different prisons. The page is searchable under FTS. Keep an ear open for updates on our show.
The Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners Calendar Collective is releasing its 16th calendar in the fall of 2016. The theme for the 2017 calendar will focus on what it takes to sustain our movements. The collective is looking for 12 works of art and 12 short articles to feature in the calendar, which hangs in more than 2,000 homes, workplaces, prison cells, and community spaces around the world. The theme guidelines are as follows. Quote, social justice movements face formidable challenges, from state repression to internal conflict to organizer burnout. Yet there are movements that manage to thrive and grow over time, welcoming new participants and contributing to ongoing struggles. What do these sustained movements have in common? What does it take to keep on keeping on over many years and hurdles? What groups can we look to and learn from as we try to find ways to strengthen our work? What lessons can we draw from liberation movement history? And how can we envision our work spanning several generations? Artists, is there a visual way to represent sustained struggles over time? What visual images from movement history prompt us to engage with these questions? Both new and archival works are welcome. As one of the editors of the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar, Herman Bell, writes, quote, "We need to review the way we, the progressive community, do our business. In other words, review how we organize, how we elicit support from other groups in support of our particular issues, what do we say to them, how do we foster stronger support from them and they from us." The collective is welcoming both artwork and articles that explore this theme, and they encourage submissions from prisoners. If you'd like to submit, here are the format guidelines. For the articles, they have to be 500 to 600 words maximum, and you're invited to include a suggested title. For the art, you can keep in mind that the calendar is 11 inches tall by 8.5 inches wide, so art with a portrait orientation is preferred. Some pieces may be printed with a border, so it need not fit those dimensions exactly. The collective is interested in a diversity of media, including paintings, drawings, photographs, prints, computer-designed graphics, collages, etc. And the calendar is printed in color, so they prefer color images. For the submission guidelines, you need to send in your submissions by May 15th, 2016. And if you have the internet, you can do that by submitting to info@certaindays.org. Or you can mail in submissions to 1455 de Maisonneuve West, Montreal, Quebec, H3G1M8, and write care of Cuperg Concordia. For those of you who don't know, the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar is a joint fundraising and educational project between outside organizers in Montreal, Toronto, and New York, in partnership with three political prisoners being held in maximum security prisons in New York State, David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes, and Herman Bell. They are committed to doing work grounded in an anti-imperialist and anti-racist perspective. They work in solidarity with anti-colonial struggles, political prisoners, and the rights of undocumented citizens and migrants. They are queer and trans liberationist. They raise awareness of political prisoners and prisoners of war in the United States and abroad, many of whom are now in their fourth decade of imprisonment. People on the streets should understand the history of today's social justice movements and how that history is linked to solidarity for political prisoners and prisoners of war. In addition to building that historical awareness, the collective emphasizes the ongoing involvement and continued commitment of political prisoners and prisoners of war in these same movements. Proceeds from the calendar will be used for direct support work for political prisoners in anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist struggles in the U.S. and Canada.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's health is fading. His supporters have asked that people call, fax, and email with the following demands. Immediate provision to Mumia of antiviral treatments to cure his hepatitis C condition that is, as his doctor testified in court, the persistent cause of worsening skin disease, almost certain liver damage, now extreme weight gain and hunger, and other diabetic-like conditions. Immediate release of all recent blood tests results to Mumia's attorneys, and vigilant monitoring of Mumia for signs of diabetes, especially of his blood sugar level, since a diabetes attack nearly killed Mumia last spring of 2015. You can write to the following people. Tom Wolfe, PA Governor, phone number 717-787-2500, fax 717-772-8284, email governor@pa.gov. John Wetzel, PA Department of Corrections Secretary, phone 717-728-2573 or 717-787-2500. You can email John Wetzel at ra-contactdoc@pa.gov. Teresa Del Balso, who's the SCI Mahoney Prison Superintendent, you can call Teresa at 570-773-2158. Dr. Paul Knoll, Director of Medical Care at the PA Department of Corrections, phone number 717-728-5309, extension 5312. You can email Dr. Paul Knoll at ra-contactdoc@pa.gov. And finally, Dr. Carl Keldy, Chief Medical Officer of Correct Care Solutions. You can phone Dr. Carl Keldy at 800-592-2974, extension 5783. You can also find all of these numbers online at prisonradio.org in the news section of their website.
According to a Globe and Mail article from March 18th, federal prisoners in Canada are suing the federal government in twin class action lawsuits seeking unspecified damages for charter infringing extensions to their prison sentences. The lawsuit was sparked by a 2011 law that prolonged prison time for people convicted of nonviolent crimes by abolishing early parole provisions. One of the lawsuits applies to prisoners who were serving sentences in prison when their early parole dates were lengthened by as many as 35 months, and the second lawsuit applies to folks who were charged but not convicted during that time period. Up next, we have an interview with John Moore. On his website, his bio reads, John Moore, an Ojibwe man from Serpent River First Nation, was convicted of second-degree murder in 1978. This happened despite the fact that he was not present when the crime was committed and had no role whatsoever in perpetrating it, and was based solely on him having spent time earlier that day with the individuals who committed the crime. His trials were tainted with systemic racism. The law under which he was convicted was ruled unconstitutional in 1987, and no one would be convicted under similar circumstances today. Yet Moore continues to bear the burden of the stigma of this conviction. In this interview, the Prison Radio Show talked with John about his situation and his current campaign for a pardon.
My name is John Seymour. I'm calling from Sudbury, Ontario, and I've been most of the day spending in the powwow, having a good time and enjoying the company of all old friends. Then I come outside to enjoy the sun so I can talk to the radio station and explain my story to.
John, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your case. What has it been? What has been your interaction, I guess, with the legal system?
Well, it's a case that of a wrongful murder conviction from 1979, and ever since I got convicted, I've been trying to get the government to review my case to get me exonerated so I can get on with my life. Because with a life sentence hanging over your head, it's pretty hard to find meaningful employment and reasonable employment. If you had money, you can always start your own business too, but that's the only thing I could do right now if I had the money to, because that way I can be my own boss. Nobody can fire me or get rid of me or not hire me. I can fire myself, but so this struggle, this battle has been going on for 37 years, trying to get my name clear from a wrongful murder conviction of a taxi driver in Sault Ste. Marie. And I was, the only connection was when I was with the two guys that did the crime. When they were the driver of the car invited me to go along for a ride with him because he didn't want to spend time with the two guys in the car by himself, so he asked me to come along for a ride. That's the only connection, just being there earlier in the daytime with two that committed the crime. So it's one of those battles. It was under a law that the phrase that they used in the theory of the crown was, you should have or ought to have known something might happen. Mm-hmm. So in putting that together, the crown attorney, all he had to do was prove I should have or ought to have known something might be going on, and that's how I got dragged into it. And then I also mentioned to a number of politicians that I wrote, MPs, I said, according to that law that convicted me, everybody in the House of Commons, in the Indian Affairs Office, or any government department that had anything to do with the residential schools, they could be all dragged to court and charged with crimes against those kids that took place. So I used that scenario, and maybe that's why they don't want to do nothing, because I'm putting them on the spot. So what happened was, according to some of the witnesses, that first trial, there was 36 witnesses called, and out of those 36 witnesses, 32 of them had absolutely nothing to say to link me to the crime whatsoever. And then at the first trial, there was no voir dires, which is a trial within a trial. And then the police officer that was put inside the cells between Stevens and myself, his notes was, as the judge put it at the second trial, was his notes was not real evidence. It was just his notes. And then, but those notes got to go in the jury room last time for the first trial. But at the second trial, it was a different story. It was both trials, there was no native jurors called, and there's eight reserves in the area of Sault Ste. Marie. And the sheriff's department, that's their job to go out and get people from the different areas to come in for jury selection. But they didn't do that job. They just collected people from the city of Sault Ste. Marie. And because the city of Sault Ste. Marie used to be only English town before, and it's just recently that they got that bilingual status again after all those years of waiting for it. So then going on to the second trial, jumping real faster to the second trial in 1982, there was less highly circumstantial evidence than the first trial. And there was only 26 witnesses called. And out of those 25 or 26 witnesses, only, again, 22 people, that their evidence had nothing that linked me to the crime. There was absolutely no DNA evidence, and there was absolutely no physical evidence whatsoever linking me to the crime. But I still got convicted after a lengthy process, or about a week of trial. And it was just, I guess I started saying it must have been because of the color of my skin, because there was my brother-in-law, who was non-native. He was charged with the murder too, but then the charges dropped against him after he became a crown witness. So from that point on, it just, I got convicted again. I went back to prison system, and I went through the process of, well, you go through maximum, then a medium, then a minimum, in the bush camp. So the process works when you're inside prison. They let you out gradually, and then when you get to these places, for instance, like Beaver Creek, when I got there, you know, I didn't think we had a prison like that, because there was no fences, and you can walk around at midnight, and then the only old fence that was there was that invisible fence that everybody knows that's there, but they just can't go beyond that point of the property. But if you let the living unit officers know that you're out walking around, then they don't say nothing. They just watch you, they know where you are, as long as you're in for count. And then, you know, what happened was I was at Mill Haven. Then I stayed in Mill Haven until the first, oh no, I was transferred out of Mill Haven to Kingston Penn. Then Kingston Penn to Warkworth Penn, and then Warkworth to Beaver Creek, and then Beaver Creek to Newbury House in Sudbury, a halfway house. It was, at the time, the only native halfway house in Canada. And so gradually, I just kept on. My letter campaign started back in 1983. The first justice minister was Mark McGuigan. He was the first justice minister I wrote to ask him to review my case. And then every justice minister since him. And now I'm just preparing another letter or package for the new justice minister, who's the first Native Justice Minister in Canada, so makes her the most powerful Native woman in Canada at this time. That's a very powerful job. That is also a conflict of interest job too, because it's more like she's the head lawyer, the top lawyer, besides being the top crown attorney. You know, he gets all this. It just gets in there. But hopefully this time around that the government will do something and instead of just keep writing me back and saying they need more information, and I kept sending for more information. They must have got at least 25,000 pages of legal information that I sent them, including the trial transcripts of the 1979 trial and the 1982 trial. The 1979 trial was, there was over 10 volumes of transcripts. And then the second trial, there was only three volumes of transcript. So you can also see the different sizes of the transcripts that were made up with the trial to get me convicted. Even though it was, like I said earlier, it was highly circumstantial evidence. And at the appeal court, getting to the appeal, at the time in 1984, I had an appeal. I had my second appeal, and it was turned down. Then I appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, which those appeal court judges that were at my hearing for the appeal, for the regular appeal, were there, and they said the judge made seven errors. So errors constitute doubt, but I guess they themselves didn't look at that doubt, and then those discrepancies in the trial, the appeal, then they should be doing something about it too. But nobody has done nothing yet. They're just thinking, well, they're Indian. Well, forget about them, let them go. That kind of stuff.
It's also important to note, too, you had mentioned that the section of the criminal code under which you were convicted.
The section of the criminal code was Section 21-2. It was the party to offense in combination with Section 213A to D. But the D section in the new criminal code after 87 is marked appealed. So that means in 1987, December the 3rd, 1987, the Vine Court's case, they appealed it to the Supreme Court of Canada, and then the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that section of the criminal code to be unconstitutional. So yeah, if you look at that, when the Vine Court's lawyer took on the appeal, his lawyer and my lawyer argued along the exact same grounds. And the only difference is Vine Court was there and I wasn't there. You know, he got the benefit of that section of the criminal code, and there was about five other cases just after that who got the benefit of that that ruling. And I haven't gotten nothing yet from the government yet. Hopefully soon. So it's a very a section of criminal code where you should have or ought to have known something might happen. You know, that is just, when I went through the case of Vinecourt's case, through the criminal reference cases there, you can see that this section of the criminal code was in conflict with the regular law for over 397 years. It was wrong for 390 years, and then in 87, it was ruled to be unconstitutional. And I'm still having problems with trying to get my name cleared. And then the history of it, it's always, there's always someone arguing that it was wrong, and sometimes they work with it, and sometimes they just put it on the shelf and forget about it. Just like my case, they forgot it and left it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your experiences in prison?
Well, the experience of being my first time, I'd never been in prison my whole life, and I was a greenhorn, I guess you want to call it. I was naive to all the different inmate code and all that stuff, but I never really got into any difficulties. I just did my own time, but it seemed like people want to do your time for you most of the time. And that wasn't right. So, but I still did my own time and survived 10 years of being locked up for the first time. And then the other thing that we should look at was that parole. You know, when I came up for parole, you know, everybody's allowed to apply for day parole at one-third of their time or two-thirds of their time. And when my two-thirds of my time come there, I didn't know nothing about asking for parole or anything, but they wouldn't give it to me anyways, and they didn't give it to me until the last year of my incarceration of that life sentence. When I finally applied in 87, they let me out on day parole, but that was 10 years already. I've been already did 10 years. And there's a recent article in the McLean's magazine, and the headline, it says, "You'll never get out," referring to every Native inmate that's locked up in prison, you know, because of all this racism crap that's going on, even out in the administration that runs the prisons, the politicians, you know, all this, it's all, and that article talks about it pretty strongly, even with those Supreme Court of Canada in June 98, the Supreme Court of Canada, they're ruling on how racism was so high, bad in Canada. It was a ruling of a 9-0 ruling, which is most powerful ruling on racism in Canada, and that was a top court. And they were talking about how, you know, people just don't have to even think about it. It just happens, and people are subject to it, especially minorities, black people, natives. Everybody else is subject to it, and yet still hardly anybody doing anything about it. I basically did my own time, and when I read, all I did was read books and go to my training area where I had to go to school for, or Millhaven. I went to school for a little while, and then when I was transferred to Kingston, I ended up going to different shops there. One of the shops was called, I can't even think of the name. They get contracts from different companies that research on birds and fish and all that kind of stuff, and they send those contracts to Kingston, and what the inmates do is insert all that data into the computer bank, and then it's there for people's easy access to it, so people can get the information they need on these items or all the different research that they had. Then I went to school for half a day at Kingston, and then one day for full day, and then this training program came into Kingston, and they had the security to want me to take the course because of my conviction of murder. It was custodial maintenance because of all the chemicals. They didn't want me to take that course. But my supervisor in the school, the school area, he fought for me, and then he finally got me into the program. So, you know, you have people like that who believe in you, and then it helps your time go by a little easier sometimes. You got an instructor that believes in you. You got a LU officer that believes in you. You know, makes your time a little easier. Same out here. There's quite a couple times that my parole officer, you know, the new ones, they go put me through all these crazy things that I have to do. One parole officer told me when I went to the CCMA that I couldn't get on buses to travel around the city, even though I didn't need to get on the buses, but that's what he put in the report, his report. Then after the 6 months was up, he wrote me another letter suggesting that I should not take the buses just because the victim said that they might run into me on the bus. It's one of the reasons they put that there. But I never had no conditions when I got released. I never had nothing. I did my time. And the first parole officer I had was awesome. He just did everything. He wrote a pass for me from January 1st to December 31st every year. And even though the police didn't like that, but all I had to do was phone them, tell them I'm heading out of town. But now I have to give them 5 days' notice before I even get a pass. Except for this new parole officer, she said that because there's a couple of times that I missed out on job, just a couple of hours' work, because I needed a pass to go out of town. They wouldn't give me it, but she said she's going to change that. So, well, I hope we'll see that. So, you know, doing time inside prison and then coming out, you're like you're doing time all over again anyways. But even though you're free, you're more freer, and you've got no fences, no borders, no nothing that's blocking your way. But, you know, you can go anywhere in the city and go for long walks in the bush and things like that, you know. But it was very, you know, very naive. I was naive when I went through the system because I'd never been in prison my whole life. All of a sudden, here I am in the big house.
How about, what is the status right now of your current letter-writing campaign? You're asking to exonerated.
That status is, I think I already explained it a little earlier, but and it's more like other people are writing letters on my behalf to the Justice Minister, to the Prime Minister, to the Indian Affairs Minister, and to their local MP, just to get them to get the government to review my case. And I already got a dozen letters that went out already, and my package to the to all 338 MPs is that's including the Prime Minister. It's, I'm working on it because I got to try to make it maybe 3 pages, 4 pages. So when I double-sided, it won't cost so much. But that's what costs money, is the photocopying of all that, of all the paperwork to get this thing done. All the envelopes are all stamped already with the address of the MPs, the House of Commons, because it's free. When you send letters to the House of Commons, it's free. So 380 package, if I was to pay for that, that would have been close to $500, maybe $600, just to mail that out. And then, you know, it just, what I do is I'm doing a cover letter, which is one page, maybe even a page and a half, and then additional information. And the additional information is like a report on summarizing all the evidence that was, you know, that was wrong, that was all circumstantial, all highly circumstantial. I'm going through certain witnesses and talking about them, getting a paragraph or two with them in it, and then I put that together and then sign it and then put it in the report, and off it goes to the Justice Minister and the Prime Minister and every MP that's in the House of Commons. And then I'll probably have a press conference just before I mail that out, either at the MP's office or John Howard Society's office, just to show the media that I'm sending it out and get a little attention. And sometimes a lot of media shows up, sometimes only 3 or 4 show up. So basically, it's getting ready to get mailed out there and have that press conference and get this ball rolling. And the other part of that story is my book. I'm writing my book that's called Long Road to Justice, and I'm just reviewing it now, just going chapter by chapter and fixing things up. You know, you go after a while, you have put it down for a while, and then you sit down and you go through it again, and all of a sudden these other things come up, they have memories that you never remembered for a long time, and then all of a sudden they come flying out. So you have to kind of squeeze in there somewhere and in the chapter and fix it up, and then it's pretty interesting just working on that book, going back to all those memories that you had, all those, you know, the memories that I'm talking about was most of the scrapping in the bar rooms when I was scrapping all the time. And those memories, I never really, never had that problem with drinking or nothing like that. I just, when I went to the bar room, I danced most of the night away and never had time to drink. And so basically, I wasn't really drunk when I left, because after you drink something and you get up to the dance floor, you're dancing, all that alcohol out of your system anyways. And I never had no conditions of not drinking when I was released. And I never took drugs in my life. And not even with the doctor orders. I don't even like taking what doctors. Any cold or flu I get, I usually fight it myself. And the two things I usually use is oregano oil. It's usually four drops, and then you put that under your tongue, and then you drink some water or something, and that thing goes into your lungs and fights off the virus that's in your lungs. And then echinacea, I do that. It's a root of a plant that's made in a pill form. But what it does is builds up your immune system. So when you're cold and all that stuff, fights it out better and keeps you stronger. And my colds and my flus don't really last too long, maybe a week. Some people, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. My friend Will Moran, one of our professors, I talk in his class, his is lasting longer because he's not doing what I told him to do. But so it is. So basically that's almost the whole story and sum up 20 minutes.
Well, maybe one final question on this long road to justice, fighting for 37 years. I guess what would be the number one lesson that you've learned throughout all of this?
Well, the number one lesson would be patience. That's basically what it is. You got to be patient when you're doing all this fighting with the government, because if you lose your patience, and like a lot of all the other inmates that are locked up, and when they come out, they get into this frame of mind that they don't have their anger under control sometimes, and then they lose it, and then they end up back going back in and out. But the one thing that I find and kept me out was just patience. You know, you got to keep patience, and then you got to learn how to that anger that's in us. We all have it, no matter who we are. Even the people that are on the street, they got that anger. But if you really want to stay out, then you just learn how to control that anger and control that, and get that patience in there. Patience and resilience, that's the other word that I use sometimes. Resilience is more like things that come into your life. You deal with it in a different format than getting angry and flipping out and throwing things around and beating somebody up or something like that, you know. So basically that was the number one lesson that I learned, because for doing this, the struggle with the justice system, it's going to be patience. Patience and more patience, because if you don't have patience, things that you'll lose your cool and something's going to happen and you're going to end up back in. If you know that you're innocent of the charge, then you fight for your right to be heard, and you fight and you fight and you don't give up. Because sometimes in life we're going to have these things in front of us, and if we don't stick with it, we're going to fall off. And the next thing you know, things are going to happen and you're going to end up back in, but then you get all depressed and everything else, and you will totally lose it. And next thing you know, you're back behind those bars, and that's not where anybody should be. I don't believe everybody should be behind bars. And well, people like Paul Barnall belongs there, but not everybody. You know, you just, when you get out, when you get your parole, and keep your nose clean and just be patient and do what you have to do. And you don't really have to do much to impress your parole officer. You just do what you have to do. Go to school, get a job, do what you have to do, and that will do itself. And then make some friends that you can be able to talk to out in the street. And when you're out in the street, you can, when you meet, because, you know, they spend thousands and thousands of dollars on psychiatrists and psychologists for us inmates to speak to. But if you just have a friend that you can count on, sit down, have a coffee, you know, it's just like seeing a psychiatrist, but you're not a psychiatrist, but you're just sharing your inner self. And then that with that in mind, it just, that could keep you out too. just having one good friend that even like if you had John Howard, you know, you go there and you speak to him. When you're speaking to them, everything's confidential anyway, so it can't be shared with anybody else anyways. But sometimes you just want to be able to go have a coffee with a friend and talk and enjoy it. Because that's why I noticed that a lot of times when I was sitting downtown by the bus, city bus people, there was a bench used to be there, and I used to sit down there and drink coffee, and then people would come just sit down and plop themselves down, and they would tell me their whole life history, and then I never see them again, ever again. Sometimes they just need that one person to be there, and then they go on, and then they survive another day.
That was an interview with John Moore. If you'd like to find out more about John's case, you can visit justiceandfreedomforjohnmoore.blogspot.ca.
The Center for Gender Advocacy invites you to this year's Thick Skin: Reflections on Race, Gender, and Political Resistance event series. On Tuesday, March 29th, 6 p.m., come hear Leila Badir, Vicky Boldo, and Harut Ayab reflect on social justice and the question, what's love got to do with it? The event takes place at the 7th Floor Lounge in Concordia's Hall Building. Also, check out the Rap Battle for Gender Freedom, a pay-what-you-can fundraiser for Couleur on Saturday, April 9th, 8 p.m. at Reggie's, also in the Hall Building. The events are wheelchair accessible and free childcare is provided with 48 hours notice. For more details, call 514-937-2110 or visit genderadvocacy.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The time is presently 11:47 a.m., and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
We are joined in the studio right now by Karine and Sarah, two of the organizers of the demo that happened last weekend in support of women prisoners who have been moved from Tongay Prison on the island of Montreal to Leclerc Prison in Laval. Hi, welcome to the Prison Radio Show.
Hi.
To start, can you just remind people a bit about the context for why this demo took place? I know we've been seeing a lot about the closure of Tongay and the situation in Leclerc and the news lately. Can you guys talk a bit about what has been happening and why?
Yes. So I'm Karine. I'm from the collective Toute Détention est Politique, and this translates into all incarceration is political. And our mandate is to solidarize with folks that are incarcerated, and we had we used to have contacts that were in Tongay, and they did a manifesto to denounce the insalubrity, the lack of healthcare, the the food that they received, and all these things, and so now with the transfer, what happens is that first it was done super rapidly and in bad ways, and now they face harsher conditions, and so they had programs. They used to have programs in Tongay for like mother and child and other programs, and now that they're in Leclerc, right now there's no programs yet, and we're not sure. In fact, we don't think that they'll follow. And Leclerc used to be a men prison, a men jail, and then so it is mixed right now, and the it's not organized to receive both, and it can lead to many situations with which they are not like ready to deal with. So our concerns is that we want to be there from the outside to support their struggles, because we know that it's not going well, and I don't think it's going to go well soon. And we want to make sure that they have their voice proposed. yeah, c'est un bon mot. Okay. Proposed, like, in the outside.
Why did people, I mean, you answered this partly already, but why did people feel like it was important to plan a demo specifically for the folks being moved from Tongay to Leclerc?
Yes. So yeah, I touched a bit about it, but we used to have contacts in Tanguy, but now these people have been released, and we want to create new contacts in the jail to be able to follow up about what are the conditions there and to make sure that they're treated well in brackets, but not in brackets, but yeah, in the context. Yes, we just wanted to go there and say, hi, we're still there and we'll be there if you want like to share with us, and yeah.
Do you guys want to talk about how it went on the day of the demo? Where did you guys go? Are there any particular aspects you want to highlight, things you thought went particularly well?
Sure. So we were about 50 people, and we took a bus from Ahuntsic in Montreal to Laval, just to say that it's like pretty difficult to get people out to Laval because it's like difficult to get to by public transit. You have to organize all the transport to get people out there. It's not like a a place that is easy to get people to go to. So we were about 50 people. We had a marching band with us. It was like a pretty like high-spirited, festive crowd. We marched from the parking lot near the prisons down Monte Saint-François, which is like the main road surrounded by three different detention centers and prisons. And we marched to Leclerc, and we attempted to get near to Leclerc prison to kind of like speak directly to the people inside to offer them solidarity and support. Unfortunately, we weren't really able to get close to the prison because a line of cops, Laval cops, formed before we could get there and weren't allowing us to pass through the road that would be right in front of the prison itself. But we made some speeches and came back and went to Bordeaux prison and Tanguay prison, the closed Tanguay prison, afterwards to say hi to folks in Bordeaux and to just, I guess, commemorate the closure of Tanguay. And it's kind of, we want to see all prisons close, but this closure didn't mean that prisoners were released. It meant that they were transferred, and this is a symbolic site to, yeah, commemorate.
I can also read a bit about what was the speeches that were read. So in front of Leclerc, we did a text that was written in French, but I want to highlight some points that... Leclerc, in fact, was closed in 2012 by the federal government because it was... I don't know how to say that. Okay, so like the site was not proper to welcome like inmates. So it was closed in 2012, and the provincial reopened it in 2014 to do a men jail. And now it is mixed. So it was already in bad conditions, and then they welcome men, and then they welcome like everyone in a setting that is not appropriate for that. So that was something to highlight. And also another thing to highlight was that the transfer of 250 women was precipitated, and it happened in a very disorganized way, in such ways that right now in the media we see the screws coming against the administration because they are angry in the way it came out to be. And so like if the screws are angry, I can't imagine how it went like wrong. So that was for what was said in front of Leclerc, and also information we have on the situation right now are not there. We have like so few information, and really we don't know what's going on inside. So that's a reason why we want contacts over there, because we know that in jail conditions can be rough, and we don't hear about it because people are there only for like less than 2 years. So, And the text that was read in front of Tanguy really focused on prison abolition, so I'm going to read it to you. It's short. We're gathered here today in front of what not so long ago was a detention center. We want to point out that this is no victory, as the people that were incarcerated here remain prisoners in a situation where they currently face harsher conditions. Keeping this in mind, however, we are gathered here today to use the symbol of an empty jail to state again our desire to see all of the prison industrial complex collapse. As this system destroys our communities and reinforces the status quo of oppression by persecuting all that is not mentally able, white, cis, hetero, manly, rich, we understand that no demand could ever bring it down, that only active resistance can succeed in liberating us. As we are here to visualize a world without prisons and the police state that is its foundation, we invite you to start or continue thinking about alternatives that we can bring to life for truly protecting and caring for our many communities. As we do groundwork for the prison system ceasing to exist, it is important that we never forget the impacts it has had on individuals, families, and communities, and it is for this reason that we will leave silhouettes here to remember that trauma is embodied, but most importantly, to remember all the people that have passed through here. We're also here today to look around us, to see who is among us, to connect or deepen our connections with each other, because hopefully this is what a community of folks devoted to anti-oppressive visions looks like. And we finish by thanking everyone for being there and sharing that precious moment with us.
Cool. Thank you so much for sharing that text. We only have about a minute remaining for this interview, so I just wanted to say if there's anything you guys want to add, if there's questions I haven't asked, also if you've gotten any responses to the demo that you wanted to share.
Maybe I would just add, but I think it's already been covered, that obviously these kinds of demonstrations are just one kind of element of a larger long-term struggle against prisons and for prisoner liberation. So while we're trying to do this kind of tangible support, which is like being outside of prison and telling people that we're there and trying to support them in that way, it's just one part of a long-term struggle. So
yeah. Cool. That's it. And I would also add that we had no mass media coverage after it. We released a communique, but it was not taken back. And we did not invite the mass media there because we wanted like to protect ourselves and also just to be among ourselves and to talk in a forward way to the prisoners. And so not getting them involved.
Mm-hmm. And if people want to find out more about the group, they can visit toutedetentionetpolitique.wordpress.com.
That's true. And if people are inside the walls, you can also write to us at the 2035 Boulevard Saint-Laurent at the third floor. So 2035 Boulevard Saint-Laurent, third floor. And we can also send to you political literatures, and we can support you in your struggle. So please don't hesitate.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. That was an interview with Karine and Sarah about the demonstration that took place this past weekend in support of prisoners who have been moved from Tanguay to Leclerc.
The time is presently 11:58, and you've been listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. Next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, April 14th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah.
And my name is Virginia.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.